ईषद्धर्मावृतं शिष्टो लोकं धर्मे नुवर्तयां गुप्तचिद्धर्मसिद्धूनां षष्टतत्परिपन्थिनाम्। Word meanings. Eshaha.
Eshaha.
This king Prithu.
This king Prithu.
Dharma Britam.
Dharma Britam.
Of persons executing religious activities. Shreshta.
The best.
Lokam.
Lokam.
The whole world.
The whole world.
Dharme.
Dharme.
In religious activities.
In religious activities.
Anuvartayan.
Anuvartayan.
Engaging them properly.
Engaging them properly.
Gopta.
Gopta.
The protector.
The protector.
Cha.
Cha.
Also.
Also.
Dharmasetunam.
Dharmasetunam.
Of the principles of religion.
Of the principles of religion.
Shasta.
Shasta.
The chastiser.
The
chastiser. Tat paripanitinam.
Tat paripanitinam.
No, excuse me. Tat paripantinam.
Tat paripantinam.
Of those who are against religious principles.
Of those who are against religious principles.
Translation. This king, Maharaj Prithu, is the best amongst those who are following religious principles. As such, he will engage everyone in the pursuit of religious principles and give those principles all protection. He will also be a great chastiser to the irreligious and atheistic. So, in other words, this verse is saying he's establishing religious principles, he's living by them, and he's engaging everybody. He's engaging everyone, he's giving them protection, establishing religious principles, living by them, and then chastising those who don't follow. Comprende? No.
Comprenden?
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 Sí. Más o menos? Todos?
Sí. Sí, sí.
The duty of the king, or the head of the government, is described very nicely in this verse. It is the duty of the governmental head to see that people strictly follow a religious life. A king should also be strict in chastising the atheists. In other words, an atheistic or godless government should never be supported by a king or governmental chief. That is the test of a good government. In the name of secular government, the king or governmental head remains neutral and allows people to engage in all sorts of irreligious activities. In such a state, people cannot be happy despite all economic development. However, in this age of Kali, there are no pious kings. Instead, rogues and thieves are elected to the head of government. Yeah. You know what a rogue is? A rogue is like criminal. Yeah. Right? A bad criminal.
Doesn't show like has no authority. He just
he's lawless and doesn't follow anybody. Does whatever he wants. And thief, you know, because you live in Mexico. See? Thief? Comprenden? Thief? Thief. That's why there are gates on all the houses. You know, See, where there's a very strong government, you don't need gates, because there's no thieves. Because as soon as they catch a thief, it's kind of over, chop his hands off or do something that prevents people from becoming thieves. Mm-hmm. In Saudi Arabia, the devotees were there years ago, and they said the same thing. They said the punishment for thievery is you get your hands chopped off. And he said, people leave their doors open, their homes unlocked, because there's no thieves. Instead, rogues and thieves are elected to head the government. But how can people be happy without religion and God consciousness? The rogues exact taxes from the citizens for their own sense enjoyment. And in the future, the people will be so much harassed that according to Srimad Bhagavatam, they will flee from the homes, they will flee from their homes and country, and take shelter in the forest. However, in Kali Yuga, democratic government can be captured by Krishna conscious people. If this can be done, the general populace can be made very happy. One of the things we should realize, reading this purport, is that Prabhupada is revealing how he's thinking. Because you might think, of what consequence is it to describe rogues and thieves in government? Because Prabhupada's saying that Brahmins should be guiding Kshatriyas and that Krishna consciousness, Krishna conscious people should be running countries. It reveals his thinking. So in establishing our movement, that's what Prabhupada was thinking. Hoping or desiring that would be, that in Prabhupada's, you could say his vision or his mission would be to make the world Krishna conscious. And I think it's pretty clearly revealed here, isn't it?
Yes.
In Kali Yuga, however, democratic government can be captured by Krishna conscious people. If this can be done, the general populace can be made very happy. From what I understand, or my memory, of course, if you study law, which I didn't, but people told me. Memory is, after years of seeing an incident or experiencing something, memory gets warped. You understand warped? Mm-hmm. Your memory of an event can change. So the story you tell, you have a new historia.
Historia.
Different. Even two people see the same event, they have a different story. But if my memory serves me correctly, at least how I understood it, that some devotees became inspired by reading Prabhupada's instructions regarding the teachings of Prahlad Maharaj, and there's a verse. It says, I'm forgetting the Sanskrit, Prabhyos Dharmam Bhagavatam. You should take Krishna consciousness up when you're young, from the beginning. Anyway, that's what Prahlad taught his friends, because they said, we're young, so we don't need this. And he said, no, you should do it. You do it from the beginning. So as I remember, a devotee read this, instruction of Prahlad Maharaj, read Prabhupada's purport, or read Prabhupada, and he didn't read, he read Prabhupada explaining, and then he started a Gurukul. That's my understanding of how the first Gurukul started. It wasn't that Prabhupada told him start a Gurukul here, as far as I remember. But as I was told, he got inspiration, and then he actually started it, which generally you would think Prabhupada just told someone to do it. I could be wrong, but it makes a good story anyway, because then I can explain the next point. So let's accept that it's true. And if that's not true, certainly other things are true. Other projects were started by reading a purport and seeing what Prabhupada wanted. Now, if you read the purport, this purport in the same way, what is Prabhupada saying? If this can be done, which means try for it. If you're capable, if you could do it, if somehow or other we could capture the government. So that would mean at least if someone is in a position that they can do that, we would encourage them. You're preaching somewhere. Even if it's for a small office, then we would encourage them and say yes. Or somebody studying political science and they're inclined to go into politics, we would say, yes, this is what Prabhupada wants. Gradually. Can you imagine the whole Senate were devotees? You know, 1,000 years from now, devotees got, you know, wow, that'd be amazing, huh? So, Prabhupada's making 2 points, that as Kali Yuga progresses, you will see leaders as thieves and rogues. And now you'll say, well, is Obama a thief and a rogue? It doesn't seem like it. But are there thieves and rogues behind him who want to create an upper class and a lower class and no middle class? Yeah, of course, there. Yeah, conspiracy theories, this and that. There's so much information on these topics. But generally, to find benevolence at the highest positions of government is becoming more and more rare. Nelson Mandela, he was very benevolent. He only took half his salary. When he became president, he said that this salary is twice what I need. So he started a foundation and he gave half his salary to a foundation. Interesting, huh? So they're not, you know, Prabhupada saying leaders are thieves and rogues, it doesn't mean that they're at this point in time, everyone's a thief and a rogue and they're just getting into politics to steal money. But more and more, as Kali Yuga progresses, that's happening. And you see in some countries, it's completely like that. Nobody is getting into politics for benevolence. And if they are, they can't do anything because the odds are against them. Because you try to reform a system, they don't want it reformed. And I've spoken to people in politics who've told me that. They said they tried to reform the system and they didn't want it. There's land, it's agricultural. They pass laws that are going to change that to commercial. Now all the members of parliament know that, so they all buy that land. And then it changes to commercial, and now the land's worth 10, 20, 50 times more. That's just, they can't help themselves. It's very common. And in many countries, people accept that. It's just how it is. They don't even, I guess they've never seen a real leader, so they don't know that there can be one. So, anyway. It's interesting, because at least that's how I read it. And then I was telling you, I read elsewhere where Prabhupada said, because they don't know how to run a government, you don't have to pay taxes. You should hide your money.
Really?
Yeah, Prabhupada said, it's not wrong. When you have governments like this, it's not wrong to hide your money. You know, because generally we say, look, you should be honest and you should pay your taxes. Now it's saying, hide your money. Prabhupada said, in these kinds of situations, I mean, in a pious kingdom, you give 25%. That's standard. At least if you're a farmer, you give 25% of your production to the government. And at least in those days, because the weather was good, which was said to be the responsibility of the king, that would blow a few minds if you said that today. Mm-hmm. But by establishing religious principles, there was no irregularity in the weather, and so seasons were normal. You would get, every season you'd get the same weather, which is ideal for growing, but if you get tons of rain when it's not supposed to rain, or you get a frost when it's not supposed to, it ruins crops. So that happens a lot. So could blame the king for the weather. So as I understand it, when the seasons are normalized, the production is sufficient. So giving 25% is not much. And but in a government in which money is squandered, then it's not wrong to not pay your taxes. Mm. There's another point Prabhupada makes. A king should not support an atheistic government. And then Prabhupada goes on to say that, see, now government is secular. And Prabhupada said, government, he said, if you want to make it secular, then you can't promote any one religion. So that's a problem, right? With Islam, they want to promote their own religion. It was a problem with Christianity, right? You all, either you become Christians or you get the sword. Bible or the sword, right? Prabhupada said that in a lecture. One hand the Bible and one hand the sword. So if you don't take the Bible, you get the sword. You get a free head massage. It just chops it right off. Yeah. Free head massage. Imagine, you know, what kind of people would do that. So Prabhupada said that you can't promote any one sectarian religion, but you have to uphold religious principles. And that's what this verse is saying. Okay, so you're a Christian, that's fine, but what is Christianity? I can't give your church a license to say that you're a Christian church if you're not following religious principles. So I have to, it's something like you have a health department and they'll go to the restaurants and they'll check that you're up to standard, right? Or if you're building, there's building codes. This is how electricity should be done, so it's safe. This is how the structure should be built, so it's safe. They have codes. I think even they have codes of color, and you can't paint your house purple and yellow and pink in some country, in some places, right? There's just codes. Right? In Mauritius, they do it. In India, they do it. So Prabhupada was saying that the government can take that position, that you have a religious organization, okay, you're a Christian, you're a Muslim, all right, these are the principles. That we require that you uphold those principles. Interestingly, so we're not trying to make, the government is not promoting one religion, but it's promoting religious principles. That's its duty, it has to uphold religious principles. And now, of course, because it's Kali Yuga, nobody wants that. And you think, for example, a non-Christian who would become a president of the United States? No, because the United States sees itself as a Christian country. Doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was like, yes. You know, the presidential candidate. Does he go to church? That's a bonus, right? Mm-hmm. If he doesn't go to church, if he's an atheist, if he's Jewish, what to speak of Muslim or Hindu? He would never be voted because we see the country as Christian. So they're more attached to being Christian in name than actually following religious principles. And that's why sometimes we try to preach to Christians, not preach, we talk to them about religious principles, and their whole point is you have to accept Jesus. You know, forget religious principles. That's like, that's just piety, that's morality. You understand? Yeah. Have you had that experience in speaking to Christians?
Yes. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. You can't talk about religious principles. So Christianity has come to this point where it's not even based on religious principles. And the government, you know, what's the requirement to establish a non-profit or a religious organization? Not that the government's going to check to see if you're following religious principles and give you a citation. Right? We found your priest drinking wine. Right. If we find it again, we take away your license to teach religion. We found that you teaching this principle, this is not Christianity. If you teach that, we shut you down. Could you imagine? But anyway, that's what Prabhupada's saying here. And then the last thing that Prabhupada's saying, or additionally, he's saying that he should not allow atheism. Atheism is not allowed. We have an island for the atheists. I don't know what they did with atheists. I don't think we're not going to kill atheists, but atheistic principles are not allowed. Like that joke, you know. What was that after the shooting? They said they should, you know. What was that joke? They should.
Which one?
There's a shooting in school, and the lady says they should.
Oh, you know. Yeah, it's like, how did God let this happen? He's not allowed in here.
How did God let this happen? And, you know, after a shooting, he said he can't do anything. They don't let him in the school.
He's not allowed in here.
So that's what Prabhupada's saying here. Okay, you might have atheists. That's one thing. But you can't have atheistic principles dominating. Right? So now as Kali Yuga progresses, you see more atheism is more and more popular. God is becoming, he's losing popularity. Isn't he? He was more popular in the past.
For instance, though, there's like in the U.S., if there was no Christianity and it was atheistic, humanistic, you think it'd be worse or better? Because there's a whole movement of humanism and they still believe in cultivating virtues and values and morals. Yeah. But it's not hinged on doing it because I have to do it or I must or I'm a bad person. It's just doing it out of, one, common sense, two, because it's the right thing to do.
I mean, the textbook answer is no, because one who's religious develops all good qualities. But at the same time, Kali Yuga is so screwball. You understand screwball?
No.
Mixed up.
Como loco. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mixed up. It's. Mm-hmm. One hand, someone has good qualities. The other hand, he's a child molester. You know.
In the same family.
Yeah, the same. Yeah, like, things are so topsy turvy, mixed up. So what Prem Kishore is saying is, you find people who are very virtuous, have a lot of virtues, who are atheists, and people who are very criminal. In a sense, who are religious, or very tamasic in their nature. And of course you have the Crusades, which was why people one of the reasons people are so down on religion, because, you know, now you have the Islamic movements. They're doing horrible things to people in the name of religion. So Prabhupada said, if you become Krishna conscious, you'll develop all good qualities. And if you're not, you can't have any. So, but it doesn't mean if you're not, you can't have sattvic qualities. You just, your qualities won't be, they won't, it's like, you could be humble and be an atheist. But humility is defined as dependence on God. That I'm totally dependent on God. I can't protect myself. That's humility of the highest sense. But if you don't believe in God, you can't have that humility. So you have a kind of a sattvic form of humility that's atheistic. So I guess you could say that's better than people going around chopping off heads in the name of God. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
But it's not better than full manifestation of God-conscious humility, which is what real humility is. So it's kind of like, you know, they can have good qualities which are shadows. And if those good qualities are employed in Krishna consciousness, then they're perfect. And you can have kind of a low number of good qualities and maybe a few bad qualities, but you're engaged in devotional service, so that's your saving grace. But on a day-to-day basis, your behavior may not be better, it could be worse in some ways. So, would it be better if every would it be better for converting America if the whole country were atheistic? That's basically the question, isn't it? I like Catholics. They're easy to make devotees. I'll tell you my experience. We were doing a yoga retreat in Canada. So it was all yoga people into yoga. And when it came time to speak about anything religious or pious, there was only one person who got it. And she was a lady who was born in the Philippines who was a Catholic. Nobody else vibrated on that level. They vibrated more on the level of sattva, feeling peaceful, elevating yourself, being good, feeling good about yourself, these things. But when it came to God and all that, I felt she was the only one that really resonated with that. And it was a confirmation of the problems that you get when you go secular. You know, and you teach yoga and they kind of, you know, what's the word? They eliminate all the spiritual, you know, most of the spiritual stuff. And even I've seen some teachers teach the spiritual stuff. I'm not sure if people really get it or want to get it. So my gut feeling and experience would be if the whole world were Catholic and Jewish, you could make a lot of devotees. I don't know if anyone's done any research. That's just my observation. Most devotees are Catholic. At least in the early days, it was Catholic and Jewish, most of them.
So we have like undercover devotees.
Going to the Catholic Church.
Catholic preachers.
Yeah. Maybe we could start our own Catholic church. Our own denomination.
There's a church in the city where it's all by devotees and they have deities in the church. And
wow. That's wonderful.
Where's that?
It's in the middle. It's actually in the middle of the...
I saw it.
One part. Yeah,
I saw his copens hanging out the window, I think.
Yeah,
gardens. It's just the devotee that lives there.
No, the owner, it's a devotee, the father of a devotee. Mm-hmm. He lives, and the other boy lives upstairs.
Mm-hmm. Someone has to start making breakfast. I joke, but there's some truth to it. I think the solution for Islam is atheism, because that would stop the killing. But I don't think it's a solution for the world. It's a tough question, you know, because if a pious, innocent person becomes a born-again Christian, then, as we know, they're going to generally they'll maintain their meat eating and they'll maintain some kind of adversity to all other religions, which is obviously not good for bringing people to Krishna consciousness. So my sense of it is that the best candidates are religious but not affiliated with any religion that would make them unable to accept Krishna consciousness, or make them think Krishna consciousness is of the devil. Right? But if they have God consciousness and it's just general, I think they're better candidates than atheists. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to test that because there are not that many atheists out there, and there are atheists who became devotees. what my personal experience is, the more there's piety and religion in people's life, which is not sectarian, the easier it is to preach to them. Easier it is them to give them Krishna consciousness. I'm sure that's your experience also. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people will come and challenge us because they're of a different religious faith. So we're not interested in converting them if they don't want to be, if they don't want to change. And they're not, the people, they're not our niche market. So if you said, who's worse between them and an atheist, I would say they are. Because an atheist, you have, you know, there's more, at least there's a chance. There's no chance with those other people unless they become frustrated with their religion and become non-denominational or something. Right? So I would say, I mean, people who have some belief in God but who are not fanatically attached to any practice or religion. Then you have the people in yoga, and then the people in yoga, they're in some of them are a little bit like religious people who have their own church and way of thinking. You know, if they evolve to a certain point, then they'll, the advantage is they'll do kirtan and they'll hear from us. But they may already know a lot of things that are not exactly perfect. And it's obviously it's harder to unteach somebody than it is to teach someone who doesn't know much. And so generally you find people who take to Krishna consciousness don't know much, that much. Or what they know, they very quickly realize is wrong. But if you think, yeah, I do that, I know that, I'm good, I'll add a little bit of what you have to my life, then you won't see much transformation. I'm just speaking in general, it's not across the board, but there's that. You know, I would say if you had a room full of very pious people who had interest in Eastern philosophy, you would find more receptivity than a room full of yogis who were well acquainted with it. That's my experience. Externally, you'd find the yogis very receptive, but in the long term, in terms of adopting a lifestyle or practice, the group of people, just general people, might be better. Mexico, it may be different because the yoga people are just beginning and they don't know a lot. So we might be the ones who tell them. Right? So they might be great, I don't know. But generally, the more they know, the harder it is. You know, it's like, if you know the wrong thing, then you have to unteach it, and it's hard. Right? Mm-hmm. I think it's different in every country also. But that's just my experience in America. The more you know, the less you feel the need to know, and that you don't know that you don't know. Whereas if you know that you don't know, then you're looking, and you're more open to it. And also there's always that sense of life can give me more that keeps a person searching and looking. And like Prabhupada says, that the danger of sattva is that you become happy and then you become satisfied in sattva guna. So, you know, why do I need all this philosophy and all these practices? I'm fine. I'm happy. I do my yoga, I have my guru, I do my little meditation. You know. They're, you know, sattvic, they think right, they eat right, they're happy. They have some knowledge. So that's the trap of sattva guru. The happiness, the satisfaction, the peace. So So if people are living more in passion and ignorance, in one sense, they may be better candidates. Mm-hmm. Not always, but sometimes.
But even in Sandhagun, there is a point where you would you feel that lack of love of Krishna, right?
If you have that, if you're on that level. But not everybody's on that level. You're seeing people spiritually, you're treating them spiritually, you're living a virtuous life, you're following religious principles somewhat. So you're happy. In that happiness, there may be no impetus to go further. It would also depend on your past piety.
Because I remember when I was Buddhist and I was doing the Vipassana meditation, I was vegetarian, I had a good salad. But at one point I feel empty.
You were empty, for sure. But not everybody feels empty.
No, because a Buddhist would say you weren't doing the practice right. Just like if someone's in Krishna consciousness and they're unhappy, there must be something wrong. Right? And that's because there's a lot of...
But isn't the goal of Buddhism to be empty?
No. I mean...
Empty your material desires.
Yeah.
Be empty of material.
I was feeling empty. I was thinking... because I think I was doing good my practice, my meditation, because it's easy, it's not so difficult. But then I was thinking, and what about it? I mean, I'm doing this and nothing is changing.
Yeah, that's the joke. The joke is the Dalai Lama got a present in a box, he opened it up and there was nothing in it. Just what I always wanted, nothing. So yeah, maybe she reached nirvana and found nothing. Well, there's supposed to be bliss there. But I think you know, if somebody is looking for Krishna and they get into Buddhism, it's not going to work. Nothing. If someone's looking for Krishna, if they have that piety and those samskaras from the past, if they're looking for Krishna, nothing's going to work. So they're going to keep looking. You know, they'll get little bits and pieces from different practices, but they're going to keep looking. And some people are not looking. They don't care. They're satisfied. They get freedom from material contamination. They're situated in Satvagun, elimination of anarthas, and they're happy. It's like that experience of bliss, of happiness, relief. And they're not so much looking for love within religion. They're looking for it within this world. It's very interesting. Love and relationships are a big topic, and everyone's concerned with it. And then you go into spiritual life and they stop talking about love and relation with God anyway, and start talking about impersonal ideas.
I mean, because if a person thinks that spiritual life, Krishna consciousness, is meant to, the goal is to feel fulfilled, feel complete, feel happy, then it might go wrong, right? Because, I mean, there's a lot of people who feel fulfilled, feel complete, feel happy with their business.
Yeah.
With their practice, with their...
Yeah, like we were reading yesterday. If you lived according to Dharma, you'd be happy. But the thing is, if you live according to Vedic Dharma, you'll gradually get elevated, if not this life, another life. Whereas, if you just live, you're a good person... You do your dharma in the sense you've discovered your nature, so you act according to that. You're not excessively greedy or envious and like that. You'll be happy. But if you do it within Vedic principles, you'll advance. As Prabhupada said, scientists and philosophers are symbols of sattva. They're very absorbed in knowledge. But sattva ideally means they're following religious principles. So I think take the word sattva with a grain of salt when we discuss it, because of course it's mixed with so many other things. Some passion, some ignorance. But material satisfaction is the enemy of spiritual life. So if somebody, you know, it's kind of a paradox. Someone's a good person, and they pray on Sunday, this and that, and they're vegetarian, they do yoga, they serve, so they're happy. And there may be no need to go further.
It's like in the Quran, there's this nice verse where the angel Gabriel is speaking to Muhammad, and Muhammad's saying, so what are you trying to telling me? What, is this life not worth living, or what? And he just asks him a question, he says, what is this life but a place, a world of playing and amusement, where you preoccupy yourself and miss the greatest opportunity? And it's like, isn't that the saddest part of this world, is that you can actually experience happiness and just miss the whole point, opportunity?
Well, happiness is it's a problem. That's why Krishna says you should tolerate happiness. He doesn't say just tolerate distress. He says tolerate happiness and distress. And so you imagine you made a T-shirt and said tolerate happiness. Nobody would understand. I'm having a rough day. Why? Too much happiness. It's very difficult to tolerate it. Which is true. It is difficult to tolerate. Because too much happiness causes you to forget Krishna. Now, if you're religious, pious, it should cause you to remember. But if it's too much happiness coming from too much material comfort, opulence, sense gratification, then you can't forget Krishna. You can't think everything's okay. So it's like there's one purport in the Bhagavatam. It was a story of Devahuti and Kardama, pronounced Kardama, Devahuti and Kardama. So he wanted to renounce, and she said, but please, before you go, give me a child. He said, okay. And so he was a sadhu, and she was sadvi. So they're both living in the forest, you know, matted locks and whatever. He said, okay, so we'll have to create some opulence, and now we're getting out of austerity, we're going to beget a child. So she was living in the forest, so I think she also had matted locks. So they, with all their powers, became very beautiful and attractive, and then he impregnated her. And in that purport, Prabhupada talked about how he prepared for this stage of life and this enjoyment and so forth. And then he said, when the man's lying with his wife, embracing his wife, enjoying like that, he forgets everything about spiritual life. Isn't that interesting? It's like if things materially are really good, it's very easy to forget Krishna. And so in the Bhagavad Gita, then Prabhupada said, the pleasure one gets from sense gratification is the enemy of the spiritualist. Because I remember when I was first becoming a devotee, they were saying how the material world is miserable. And I had a really hard time understanding that, because I didn't have a miserable life. I never really had any... I lived such a sheltered life. It was so protected by... And that time in the world, it wasn't as bad as it is now. So when they said suffering, I felt like I was like Lord Buddha. I never saw suffering. Other than my girlfriend leaving me or something, that was the only suffering I ever saw. But as far as shelter, food, money, education, doctors, this and that, I didn't have any real physical problem. But just everything was there. So they'd say the world is suffering. It didn't make any sense. And then I went to this, right in the beginning of my study of Krishna consciousness, I went. It was Berkeley. Everything was, on the cutting edge of degradation. So they were doing like these programs to enlighten your senses and your sensual experience. I forget what it was. Some lectures some guy was giving. And he would show you how to enjoy your senses more. I can't remember exactly what it was. But I remember going through these heightened sensual experiences, and while going through them, I would just say, what's this nonsense that devotees are saying you can't enjoy? You know, I'm heightening my sensual experience. Which is like when you take marijuana, that's what happens. And your senses become more keen. Music sounds better. Things look different. So it was getting in the way of my Krishna consciousness. I thought, what are these guys saying? There's no enjoyment. This is amazing what I'm going through now. So the pleasure became the problem. And if the pleasure becomes the source of misery, then you're in a great position to understand Krishna consciousness, because that's the reality, that it is a source of misery. But if you're in the illusion that it's not, then why would you take this to spiritual life for any other reason than to become peaceful? So one time, these ladies came to see Prabhupada. They were practicing some form of meditation. And he said, what's the goal of your meditation? And they said, the goal is to become peaceful. And he said something like, what is this peace? We're not after peace. Because we're after service. We're after love. And if you're just after peace, it's like Shantaras. Like, what's the point? Right? Mm-hmm. So Prabhupada just really put them down, or put that idea down. What is this peace after peace?
It's selfish, right?
Just I want to feel peaceful. Now, there's another way of understanding peace. You say a devotee should be peaceful, which means he should not be disturbed by the mind and senses. So being peaceful is a requirement for Krishna consciousness. So if you say to me, what's your goal? And I say, well, one of my goals is to be peaceful. And you say, why? He said, that way I can serve Krishna better. So then it's fine. But if your goal is to be peaceful, because you feel better when you're peaceful, and you're happier when you're peaceful, where's Krishna in the equation? Now if you say, when I feel happier, I'm more inspired to serve Krishna, say, okay, as long as Krishna's in the equation, then ultimately you're doing it for him. And if it can't be used for him, you just don't do it. Or if you're doing it, you give it up. Or if you have it, you adjust it so it can be used. Yeah. Do you want to be happy? You say, no, I just want to make Krishna happy. That's right. But let's say you're unhappy and it's affecting your devotional service. Like Nityananda prays. No, devotees pray to Nityananda. Who was it? Maybe Narottam Das. I'm unhappy, make me happy. You know, but I want to be happy in Krishna consciousness. I don't want to be happy in Maya. There's a difference. So if I say, Krishna, make me happy, why would I pray to Krishna to make me happy? Because that happiness will keep me in his service, because I'm tasting. So then it's not selfish. But why do you want to be happy? Just because I don't like being unhappy. That's not Krishna conscious. So, you know, as long as things are connected with Krishna, everything's good. Once you make that disconnection, you're in trouble. Or if you don't make the connection, you're in trouble. So that's how we're trying to help people. And every time there's any question about doing anything, the answer is, or the question back is it connected to Krishna? Can you connect it? How did you connect it? What's going on inside? What's your motivation? Why are you doing this? I want to be happy. Why? Because when I'm happy, I'm out of Maya. Okay. So do things that make you happy. Kirtan, prasadam, service you like, all these things. That's perfect. Be happy in Krishna consciousness. That's what Prabhupada wants. Be happy in Krishna consciousness. Not be happy out of Krishna consciousness. As long as you're happy in Krishna consciousness, it's good. If you're happy out of Krishna consciousness, then you'll feel, why do I need Krishna consciousness? I'm happy. Right? Like I often say, and I think this is true for all of us, if I could be happy without Krishna, I wouldn't become a devotee. Why take the trouble? You know? I have to get up early, I have to do so many things. So if I could be happy without doing that, why would I come to Krishna? And which is the case for some people who've come to Krishna. They find happiness in Maya and they leave. I couldn't find any happiness in Maya. Then I became a devotee. Somehow now I find happiness in Maya. Now I can go. Prabhupada talks about that. It's in the Nectar of Devotion. He talks about those people. They were suffering. Now they came to Krishna consciousness. They're not suffering anymore. Mm-hmm. Then they leave. Mm-hmm. So we were reading this nice thing last night. It's saying that on any level of your life, physical or emotional or mental or any level, if there's some pain, some discomfort, some unhappiness, why don't you sit in the chair? If there's some pain, discomfort, like Rasika's having, no. Then you know something's wrong. But that's not natural, right? So it can be emotional pain. It could be depression. It can be a disturbed mind. That all these things are indications that something's wrong. And if you take them as indications of something wrong, then obviously you ask, what's wrong and how do I make it better? Right? So, if nothing's wrong, then you don't make any move. If everything's, you don't feel anything's wrong. No. That's the problem. So, Krishna designs the world that there'll be pain when things are wrong. And we're supposed, of course, if we're happy in Krishna consciousness, then we've come to the right conclusion.
Can I ever tell you that story of that little girl that she had a weird, I don't know if you call it a disease or a condition, where if you tickled her, she could feel it, laugh and everything. But if she broke a bone, she'd never know. She couldn't feel it at all.
Mm.
And so there was this whole news story on her, and people think, wow, that's great. You break a bone and not feel it. It's wonderful. But it was horrible for her because she'd be playing on the playground. She'd break a leg or something, and she wouldn't know, and she'd keep playing, or a toe or something, and she'd get internal bleeding. And so without that pain to tell if something's wrong.
Right, yeah, perfect. Good example. Yeah. So I think this is one of the really powerful ways that we can teach people and say, your natural condition is to be happy all the time. That's the way it should be. Just like the natural condition of your physical state is to be healthy. And as soon as you're not healthy, what do you think? You think something's wrong, there's disease, I should deal with it, right? The same way, if you're not happy, you should think something's wrong emotionally, mentally, intellectually, with your ego, with your spirit, if not all. Of course, we would say, if you get your spirit together, you'll get everything together. That's, you know, it'll come. But we can address each level. So I think that's we want to make people realize that the nature of, you know, say, the nature of life is duality, but the normal state, most of the time, is you should be happy and you should be able to deal with the duality. And if you're not, something's wrong. And that's why we can help you. And, you know, and I know you think that it's impossible to be happy all the time. But that's only because we're doing things which cause us unhappiness. And if you look at your life, you look at any unhappiness, just trace it back to something you did or something you thought. And if you didn't do or think that, you wouldn't have had that unhappy consequence. Isn't it? So, like Jayadvaita Swami used to say, something like very simple. You don't have to suffer if you don't do anything that causes you suffering. Or say, Do I have to give up everything to be a devotee? No, you just have to give up your suffering. And how do you give up your suffering? Stop doing the things that cause you suffering. And so then we present to people to say, actually, we are our own worst enemy, because the suffering that's coming to us predominantly is caused by us. And you say, no, it's my husband and wife, but then that's also how you're responding.
What do you think about the saying, pain is inevitable, suffering is
optional? Yeah. Yeah.
Or would we have a different philosophy?
Yeah, similar, you know. In other words, the idea of that statement is that there's duality in the world. That if you're in the right consciousness, you'll still be happy. I mean, you look at the life of a devotee may have to undergo all kinds of trouble dealing with all kinds of difficulties, but they're not unhappy. It's not that they come back depressed one day because they couldn't get something done. Because we're not doing anything that makes us unhappy. And we're not responding to difficulties in a way that our life depends on external situations. So that's, as long as you don't depend on external situations to make you happy, then those, when they're not good, you won't be unhappy. Your happiness is in a totally different realm. So even if conditions are not good, you can still be happy. I think we should just make that point. That's just normal. I said, our lives are so abnormal now. It's tremendous. And the proof of the abnormality is that we're all buying stuff. We're all thinking we have to get things to make us happy. Right? And that's proof that we're not happy. Because if you're happy, you don't need so much. And this whole ecology movement is failing because we're programmed to want things. And you know, as long as you want things, you're going to destroy the earth. So until we come back to a normal state, we can't get a normal state outside in the environment, because the internal environment is not normal. That's, everything manifests externally. You know, so any kind of dysfunction that manifests externally is a dysfunction internally. Right, and everybody's trying to fix things externally. Enact this law, do this, put you know, these filters on industry, and put these filters on cars to purify the air. Yeah, that's great, you know. But why do you need all this industry? Because everybody wants things. So if everybody didn't want all these things, half the industries would close down. Of course, they don't want that to happen because they... So that would ruin the economy. It's just, you would create a different economy. So as long as people want to live on a very high standard, they'll talk about ecology, but it won't change. And then you can enact laws and try to force people, but that's not efficient.
There was a talk Ramana Swami was giving. Last talk that once in the airport, the Minister of Environment, in India, came to him and started to argue about what do you do for the environment,
right,
with the pollution, all this stuff. And he told him that the road of the pollution outside is the pollution inside. And if we don't clean inside of us, there is no point in cleaning outside, because in one point we are going to
continue to pollute.
You continue to pollute.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's one devotee in South Africa. He's doing his PhD on this topic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Really interesting to see what he...
The dissonance between results and... Well, not the dissonance, actually the alignment between results and the internal and the external world. The external world... See, what we want to teach people is that the external world is just mirroring the internal world. And if you try to change the external world, it's not really going to work, because you have to, because the internal world will always modify it back to the way it was. You know, so this is the basis of any kind of change. It's not, so we say we're creating a revolution. Or we say the real revolution is in consciousness. You know, if you try to create the external revolution, it won't last. There'll always be people who come along and pollute it and exploit it. You know, a good cause and then the wrong people come along. So if you create the revolution in consciousness, everyone has the right consciousness, then the results will manifest outside. So this is our mantra. Your outer world is a reflection of your inner world. You know, this the pollution in the environment is, as you said, it's a reflection of internal. It's really specifically is a byproduct of greed. And our economy, for it to prosper, we have to feed greed. And so everyone's overspent because everyone's bought into this lie that the more you have, the happier you'll be. And when you see other people having things you don't have, you become envious. So we've been programmed that way, rather than being programmed for self-satisfaction. That's the problem. So until that changes, you know, you can have, it's good that you have movements for the environment, but they'll not be completely successful. They'll have some success in some ways, but not fully. So that's really our message. You know? And it's a powerful message. If you're not happy 24/7, there's something wrong. If you're not physically well 24/7, there's something wrong. If you're not emotionally well 24/7, there's something wrong. If your mind is disturbed, there's something wrong. It's not normal. It's not the way it's supposed to be. So if we make that point to people, this is not the way life is supposed to be. Is it? We've lost touch with our souls, with how to live. And if you learn how to live, then you'll be happy, always. And even when you're not happy, you'll be okay, because you'll know how to deal with it. So like you say, you know, what do you teach people? We teach people how to be happy all the time. And then people will think, you can't do that, it's not possible. Unless you drink beer 24 hours a day. Yeah. So what is the condition of our society? We're not happy. So because we're not happy, then we become addicted to alcohol, sex, drugs, sports, hobbies, right? It's all these, you know, okay, alcohol addiction is a worse addiction than addiction to football, but football is still an addiction. It's a way to find pleasure that you're not finding within your own life. And then when the football game's over, you come home, right? Come home and fight with your wife or something, because you're not happy, right? You know, like, we used to go surfing, yeah. When the surf is good, it's amazing. It's like, you know, next best thing to kirtan.
Yeah, there's a documentary on big-time surfers in Hawaii. It's when the swell comes in, they're extremely happy, but the rest of the year they're depressed. Like, it's a clinical, like, the clinical
amazing,
depression.
Amazing. Because the surfing is so, it's such a high. You know, I saw this thing about the history of the Hell's Angels or motorcycle groups, and it originated, I think, after World War One. I think it was World War One. Could have been World War Two, but I think it may have been World War One. These fighter pilots, their life was so exciting, and it just when they came back, it was so, you know, big motorcycles riding fast, something exciting. Anyway, if people are trying to be happy materially, then it's like what we did today. You walk up the big hill. You just have to walk up the big hill to get to the top. And that was like a lot of struggle to get to the top of that hill, right? A little bit of pain and huffing and puffing. And that's what you're doing. You do your austerity, you get your result, you get your happiness. You do your austerity. And so we say, claim your happiness. You already have it. It's not at the top of the hill. It's not here. Just claim it. If you look at the 12 points that I brought up, there's more than 12 points you could teach about being happy. But if you look at the 12 points, the opposite is what causes misery. Like one of the points is accept. Just accept things as they are. So what's the opposite? Don't accept. So where does your misery come from? Not accepting. Let it go. Another principle, let it go. What's the opposite? Don't let it go. And what are we talking about? Let it go. Let it go of the jealousy, the envy, whatever. So you're by not letting go, by holding on, let's say, being positive here, by holding on, you're suffering. You're causing your own suffering. If you just let it go, you would stop suffering. So you're not living a normal life. It's not normal. That's not the normal state. That's not the pure state of consciousness. And you have that pure state, you're happy. That's just God, you know. Even our goal isn't just to make people happy. Our goal is to make people happy in spiritual life. But part of our goal is to show people how they're making themselves unhappy. Because these, if you don't follow spiritual principles, you can't be happy. And then as a result, you have to do something to try to make yourself happy, which is full of austerity, that can only make you happy for a while. Right? So you get yourself caught in this problem. You're not finding it internally or allowing yourself to experience it because you're doing things wrong. So then what do you have to do to be happy? You have to overstimulate, over-medicate yourself. And then that's, you know, it's not going to work. There's byproducts, there's results, consequences. So it doesn't work. So I think it's a really powerful platform for us. If you're not happy all the time, you're out of line, you're out of tune, you're out of alignment. We'll tune you up. What do? I tune people up. We have a 7-point checkup. Body, emotion, mind, consciousness, intelligence, ego, spirit. We do a 7-point tune-up. Really? That sounds like an interesting job. Yeah, it's very interesting. Because 99.99% of the people are out of tune. And when you're in tune, you're happy. Right? So I think that's what we want people to know. And if they can accept that, you know, believe that, then they'll be interested. And, you know, and then when they share this, they'll say, well, what did you learn from Soul Tools? Well, I learned that I needed a tune-up. And I learned that you can be happy all the time. And then if you teach people that and they become happy and they overcome their misery and they can deal with all the difficulties in their life, then they'll want to share that happiness with others. Sometimes a devotee is very blissful. And people will see that devotee. They'll say, why are you always happy? What's wrong with you? It's almost like they don't like it. You know, not they don't like it, but it's almost like something's wrong with you. That you're not supposed to be happy all the time. Right? So we can say, you know, here at Soul Tools, there's something really wrong with us. We have to admit this. We're always happy. You know, that's like, nobody's always happy. So we're like, there's something wrong with us. We're weird. We're like misfits in society. You know, people look at us and go, something's wrong with you. You're always happy. Why are you always happy? Don't be happy all the time. Be like all of us. Just be normal. Be miserable sometimes. You know, we don't like it. You're always happy. Makes us feel bad. Yes? Okay. Prita Maharaj ki jai. Jai Premanandi Hari Hari.